Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. On this weekend show, we're going to spend majority of the show with one of my favorite guests, Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of the Book Report. I will post a link to Peter's site, that Book Report site, where you can keep up to date with Peter's comments on economic data, market moves, and any key news that he thinks is very market noteworthy and very market moving. Peter, I want to start off really big picture here with 2022 being a very different year for markets. U.S. markets have trended lower pretty much all this year. We've seen a rush into commodities. That was even happening last year, but seems to be a more defensive strategy this year. We have the Fed there, well, starting to hike rates now. There's just so much going on this year that I think people get bogged down with all of this information, all of the news. In your eyes, what's the most important thing that you've noticed this year that really shows the difference that we're seeing in markets and in investors' mentalities?
Well, I think it's the very sharp move in interest rates in a very short period of time. And the delay of the Fed to respond to rising inflation over the last couple of years, it just ran them over. And now that they finally have come around to the need to raise interest rates more notably than they probably wanted to, the move in, call it the U.S. two-year yield, and to use that as a sort of a Fed proxy in terms of pricing in those short-term interest rate increases. The two-year just a year ago, was 15 basis points. Today, it's almost 215 basis points. At the beginning of the year, it was 73 basis points. We've almost tripled in that yield in just under 3 months. So that, to me, is quite unbelievable. And then you can throw in, of course, the decline in the number and the dollar amount of negative yielding bonds, which, speaking of 1 year ago, was something north of $14 trillion. And today, or as of yesterday's close, that pile is actually down to just $3 trillion, which is the lowest level since late 2015. So that shift in response to inflation, in response to central banks both being late and then finally coming around to this, I think is what is most noteworthy. Of course, putting aside the war, I mean, that's the most tragic, of course, but that, to me, just accelerates trends that have already been in place, and that's the rallying commodity prices and a shift to continue persistent inflation. And I think from here going forward, the question is how does the global economy respond both to this spike in energy and food prices and other things post-war, and how does the global economy respond to this move in interest rates? Well, because at least the U.S. economy is obviously very dependent on low interest rates, and with housing and autos being key parts of the economy and obviously the most directly impacted by changes in interest rates, what is the response there? You would have to believe that things are going to start to slow, if not already. And that's what is to come in this macro world.
Well, Peter, that's a great point to think about, is that the growth is slowing, but the interest rates are rising, and that could impact consumers. It could change the profitability of businesses. But you also have this Fed rate hiking cycle starting, as you pointed out, so far behind the curve, with CPI rates at 7.9% and the Fed first rate hike only being at 25 basis points. It's not really going to tame inflation at that point. So we have this kind of stagflationary backdrop with rising inflation, rising energy prices, rising wages, slowing growth. Is it possible they're getting ready to create a kind of a big error by having waited so long? And are we getting near that tipping point where it could go from a stagflationary environment to almost a recessionary environment, maybe a year out or so?
Well, the mistake has already been made by waiting as long as they have. So that's in the books. It's just a question of how compounded does that mistake get? And that will obviously depend on many things, but it will get compounded because the rate hikes will obviously slow the demand side of the economy, particularly housing and autos. Shrinking their balance sheet will have a direct impact on financial conditions and asset prices. And we're already seeing the impact of this changed market landscape. There was an article in the Financial Times yesterday that talked about some of the capital market responses to this changed interest rate landscape and adjustment in equity valuations. There were no IPOs between mid-February and mid-March, according to Dealogic. And the FT said that outside of a holiday period, it marked the longest period without one since 2017. They also talked about equity sales, whether it's secondaries and just generally, has fallen almost 90% from where it was a year ago. Junk bond sales are down 70% from where they were a year ago. So the capital markets response has started. Now we just have to see to what extent is the Fed going to tolerate the tightening of conditions and slowing of the economy. Now, they're purposely trying to do that in order to quell inflation. The question is how much will be needed to do that and how much are they willing to tolerate? In other words, the trade-off between slower growth and shrinking inflation, where's that line going to be? We don't know the answer yet.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? We don't know the answer, but I think everybody does, for the most part, see the writing on the wall where when we do have a tightening Fed and quite frankly, kind of that reopening boost trade that is now starting to dissipate because consumers are quite frankly just running out of cash. What is that breaking point? Question is though, Peter, do you think any economies or markets can withstand this trend that really is globally of higher rates?
Well, those that are least indebted can handle it. The problem is that I don't know of any, relatively speaking. There are some, but in the aggregate, everyone is obviously taking advantage of very low interest rates and have taken on a lot of debt. So that makes us very sensitive to even modest changes in interest rates, because you'll always hear someone say, oh, yeah, but rates are still so low. Well, they are historically speaking, but like I said, small changes in interest rates, when they're so low and debt is so high and we become so dependent on credit to drive economic growth, small changes have an impact. I mean, you look at the U.S. mortgage applications came out yesterday. So for the weekend, I think last Friday, refis in 1 week were down almost 15% in 1 week, week over week, because of the leg higher in interest rates. Now, obviously, that makes a lot of sense for the consumers to respond like that. But to see, you know, such a sharp drop, and they're down like 54% year over year. That's, of course, because so many people have refied in 2020 and 2021 that you run out of people, but they're certainly disincentivized when rates rise. But that, again, that is to come in terms of its broader impact. You know, there's a big debate now in the housing market about the demand side. And you listen to some of the home builders have the reported earnings, like KB Homes this week or Lennar, you know, they'll tell you that the demand side is still very strong. And I think in some parts of the market, maybe it is, but I think there's no question that consumers have gotten sticker shock between high prices and now rising mortgage rates. And the only reason why demand may be strong is because they just want to buy a home to take advantage of rates where they are before they go higher. But once sort of that pent up, dense sitting jump off gets satiated, then I think we'll get to see what real demand is with rates where they are, where the 10-year mortgage rate in the U.S. has gone from 320, 330 a year ago to 4.5 as of yesterday.
Yeah, Peter, that's an interesting point on the real estate market, because as the rates start to rise, there is going to be that choke point where it'll crush demand. And what will usually happen in that environment is the prices of housing will come down as the rates are going higher, which kills some of the wealth effect. And so I was going to ask you about the wealth effect anyways. The markets have pulled back, the general equities, really since the end of last year. A lot of tech stocks are down in a big way. A lot of the general markets are still down on the year. So that wealth effect is waning as far as how people feel. And when you hit them on the other side with inflation and costs going up and almost everything from the gas pump to the grocery store, is there a point where some people may start getting a little more defensive. We've seen the precious metals do well, even in the face of the rate hikes. Do you think more people will start looking at defensive and safe haven plays in this kind of an environment?
Well, I think that that's for sure going on. I think everyone has got their antennas on for what is the extent of an economic slowdown globally. We know Europe is going to slow down in the face of this spike in food and energy prices and what's going on with the war and all the sanctions and all the disruptions that creates. China is, of course, slowing down. It's just a matter of to what extent at this point. And that is, I think, what is to come, as I said earlier, that will then in turn dictate where markets go and where rates go, and on top of the Fed trying to deal with, and all central banks trying to deal with, the spike in inflation.
Now, Peter, this ties into a just general conversation on U.S. equity markets and just how dependent they are on this free money. Because as investors started to finally listen to the Fed that they were going to be pulling back and that they were going to be raising rates, to me, it just makes sense that we are going to see weakness in the U.S. equity markets. And quite frankly, we have. Look at this year. It's been consecutive lower lows and lower highs. The fact of the matter is, when the punch bowl is pulled away, that money at best would just rotate into somewhere else. But can we, or do you expect at all, any sort of a bounce or even run back towards some of the all-time highs in U.S. equity markets anytime this year if this environment of easy money really is off the table for now?
I mean, I think it's highly unlikely. You know, if you break down, and I don't like making broad market calls, just because the futility of it being right. But if you break down what drives stock prices in the aggregate, it's earnings and the P multiple. You know, if I'm right that growth is going to slow this year, well, you have to believe that earnings estimates will start to slip. And with the rise in rates and tightening monetary policy, well, we've already seen a compression in the P multiple, and that will likely get furthered as we get deeper into the Fed shrinking their balance sheet. I mean, we're going to go from, just in a few months, the Fed adding $120 billion a month to their balance sheet to reducing it by $80 to $100 billion a month. And QE was purposely meant to lift stock prices, as Ben Bernanke told us in November 2010 when he wrote an editorial for the Washington Post. So you can't have the purpose of QE easing financial conditions and lifting stock prices and have QT not really have an impact.
That makes sense. And we've seen the markets pull back in tandem with that liquidity drying up. So the other thing would be a lot of newly minted traders that came on the scene in the last couple of years while they were locked down during the pandemic and started trading from home also just had some funds wiped out. So some of that money was just evaporated. So it's just not there to buy it back to the same nosebleed levels some of those PE ratios had got to. But one sector that has been moving is the commodity sector. So I'd love to get your thoughts on what we've seen in the commodities, not just since the Ukraine crisis started, but really since the beginning of the year, kind of ended last year, we've seen commodities on a run higher. What's your outlook on that space, Peter?
So, you know, I've been positive and long since September, October 2020. But I do have to admit right now, while I think the fundamentals are great and this could last, I'm just more uncertain. I think with respect to oil and gas, I still think prices go much higher, but we're already at, you know, 110 in WTI. So it's not as easy from here, even though I still expect prices to go higher. And I think oil stocks are still pricing in much lower commodity prices. Agriculture has done very well. I've been long the fertilizers up until recently, and that trade probably will continue to work out, but I've taken a break from it. Just more uncertain about what the potential demand destruction is with these spiking fertilizer prices and the lack of demand, unfortunately, out of Ukraine, since they're not going to be able to plant that much in this planting season. But the fundamentals are great. Obviously, still very positive on precious metals. I say obviously, but that's been my story for a while. And with respect to industrial metals, I still think that what's going on with the war has definitely caused even more of a constraint on supply. I'm just uncertain in the short term what the demand side is going to be like if global growth slows. So I think copper prices are going to probably go much higher in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years. Yes. But where it goes over the next 6 to 12 months in the context of slowing growth, I'm not sure.
Can we elaborate a little bit more on that when it comes to governments really needing to issue or move through some infrastructure plans. That can be a key driver for these base metals. But I think I see where you're coming from here, where if we do see some broadness across the board for economies, then base metals, industrial metals should struggle. Can governments help to save them a little bit in case we do get this, in a way, almost crash scenario?
Not really. I mean, if you look at the U.S. Infrastructure package, it's going to be spread out over 10 years. So the annual numbers being shelled out isn't just going to be that much of a needle mover. Now, of course, it will create incremental demand that wouldn't have happened otherwise. But I think in the context of the global demand for commodities, it won't have that much of an impact.
Peter, you brought up your affinity to the precious metals. Our audience is obviously also very into the precious metals and also some of the precious metals mining stocks. And what we hear, since you brought up the interest rate discussion at the beginning of this call, is that when rates are rising, that that's bad for gold because it doesn't pay a dividend and that everybody's going to be more interested in things with the yield. But we've also seen gold hold its own lately and even get very close to its all-time high again. So what's your outlook on gold and silver? And do you think they can still thrive in the precious metal sector, could still thrive in a rising rate environment?
I do. And we're seeing writ large how it works in a rising interest rate environment, as gold is not far from a record high and interest rates are at multi-year highs. And like I said earlier, we've seen a very sharp spike in a short period of time. So it's sort of proving its mettle, no pun intended, in this inflationary environment, that even with an aggressive Fed, inflation will still remain well above nominal interest rates. Therefore, real interest rates will still remain deeply negative. And you can throw in another bull case for gold, and that's how we've sanctioned Russia and we've sanctioned their central bank. And that at the end of the day now, no asset that has counterparty risk is really safe anymore. But if you're a central bank and has gold reserves in a vault underneath your feet, well, there's no counterparty risk and there's no contra liability to that. And that's probably the safest reserve you can have. So I think that gold has taken on sort of new level of importance in this new world order, where no asset is truly safe from a government that may not like you.
Yeah, what a crazy realization this is right now for a lot of people. How do you view the underlying gold stocks then, Peter? Because the majors are making money, but there hasn't been this flood of cash broadly into the actual stocks underlying gold.
Well, you will witness typical retail mentality, and I'm sure institutions to an extent, that this money will come in only after they've had a big move. And I think that fundamentals, you can argue, have never been better in terms of how many of these gold companies run their business for more cash flow and not empire building. And with all-in sustainable costs being somewhat closer to 1,000 or even 11 to 1,200 with this recent uptick in raw material prices and labor and so on, and with gold, you know, hitting these highs, I think your profit margins are pretty wide and pretty attractive.
Well, Peter, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on silver, because it's a precious metal for 5,000 years. It's been money, but at the same time, it's got an industrial component, where it sometimes tracks the commodity sector. It's got that hybrid nature. So what's your outlook on the silver market?
So I've been bullish on silver as well. And obviously, it's been frustrating in that it's still well below its highs. I think the industrial component to silver adds some sexiness to it, and that it is a key raw material in this new renewable world that people want to shift to. Now, we know that said, silver still trades with pretty much where gold is. So it finally is getting some legs, and I'm rather excited about where it goes to the upside. I think that there's a tremendous amount of upside. And if you look at the entire commodity world, name me one asset of silver that's down 50% from its all-time high. I don't know of any.
That's a very good point. Why has silver lagged so much then? Because there has been this renewed interest in the sector, and I realize, you know what, higher prices brings in more investors, but again, silver has just broadly lagged when we've seen industrial metals and even gold move much higher.
I don't know. I, I, I,
I'm confident I understand why gold and silver underperformed in 2021 after a good 2020. I think that was the belief that either inflation was not, that what was transitory, which obviously was not, or, and if it wasn't, well, the Fed would raise interest rates and QE, and that would be negative for gold, even though the lesson was the exact opposite when they were raising rates in the late, in the 70s and mid 2000s. And gold bottomed when they started raising rates in December 2015. But now I think that the bull market's resumed, and I think that silver has a lot of catch up. But you know, outside of last year's performance, that's my only explanation for why it's underperformed. You know, looking out over the past 12 plus months, actually the underperformance really started in August of 2020 when it peaked after that big move.
Yeah, we're closing in on 2 years.
Right, and then it had another attempt at a run when people thought it would be a meme stock. But that was really just a one-day response.
Yes, the silver squeeze in February of 2021. So yeah, it was almost over before it began. Mm-hmm. And it did mark a top for quite some time. Well, there's one other area that's been quite volatile, and I guess you could consider it a currency or a option outside of the fiat system, and that's the crypto markets. We hear a lot of noise about it in the markets, both bullish and bearish, and it's been a very volatile sector since its inception 13 years ago. But we have seen big moves in Bitcoin and Ethereum, followed by big crashes as the inflation got hotter, and then a recent spike back up. Do you have any thoughts on the crypto markets?
I get asked the question a lot, and I don't know yet, at least right now. I think that I have a lot of commonality with the bulls of Bitcoin in terms of its creation and its intended function of being a store of value. It's obviously not a medium of exchange, as long as it can be taxed. But from a store value standpoint, when you think about the 13 years of Bitcoin, the only thing it really knows is zero rates, negative rates, and massive QE, you know, outside of bouts of trying to reverse that. But so it's essentially only known easy money. So it's now being tested to a notable extent with much higher inflation and higher interest rates. And it's more acting like a tech stock than acting like gold. So I still think that from that sort of intended use of Bitcoin, it still needs to prove itself, and it hasn't yet. I still respect it. I watch it. Maybe I'll be long it one day, but for the purpose of wanting something, a hard asset that is not a fiat currency, that doesn't have counterparty risk, and is a good thing to hold in times of negative real interest rates and high inflation, I still would prefer to own a gold or silver coin in my hand than something on the computer. Again, I still think that there's enormous amount of optimism to be had for crypto and the whole build out of the DeFi industry. But I'm just really talking about, you know, in terms of the price of Bitcoin and whether it's serving its intended function or not, as opposed to just, like I said, following tech stocks or even, you know, the ARK ETF.
It's a very good point, Peter, that really cryptos have only known easy money markets and easy money policies. I guess we can wrap it up then with, how do you compare what we're going through just this year, 2022, in terms of all the data, all the tightening that we are starting to see, everything we've outlined in these first couple of segments here, how does it relate to any other time in history? What kind of analog are you using right now?
So I am a student of history. And I know we try to find previous moments that mimic this, but, you know, zero rates, negative rates, and all this QE to this extent was always somewhat new. I mean, never in 4,000 years of history did we see negative interest rates. So I'm not sure how analogous this time period is to previous times. You know, you can say, okay, the 70s, high inflation, this is similar. Yeah, from an inflationary standpoint, yes. But debt levels globally were much lower then. The global economy, the U.S. economy, was better able to handle very high double-digit interest rates. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. So there are similarities in some aspects, but a lot of uniqueness to others.
All right, Peter, we're going to leave it there. Really appreciate you spending these first three segments with us. Thank you again for your time. I love reading over all of your emails and everything you post on the Book Report website. We're going to have you back on probably in another month just to recap kind of where we stand. But already, boy, oh boy, this year, very, very different than any year over the last decade plus. And now we're all just trying to figure out where we go from here. And the Fed is trying to do the exact same thing. Peter, thank you again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.